AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. Matthew Miller and Kenneth Bay are back in the U.S., released from captivity by North Korea. A grateful Bay after his arrival at Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Washington.
I just want to say thank you all for supporting me, lifting me up, and not forgetting me. At the same time that I also not forgetting the people of North Korea.
Bay, a Korean-American missionary, was held for 2 years in the North. Miller was jailed on spying charges after he allegedly ripped up his tourist visa at Pyongyang's airport in April and demanded asylum. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting with Iran's foreign minister and the European Union's Catherine Ashton in Oman ahead of a final broader round of negotiations in Vienna between Iran and world powers over its nuclear program. Facing a November 24th deadline, Kerry says a deal is still possible. President Obama has a trio of summits during his week-long trip that begins in Beijing and ends in Australia. AP White House correspondent Mark Smith has more.
In Beijing, the president's attending the annual Asia-Pacific Summit. Then in Myanmar, it's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Finally, in Brisbane, Australia, he'll be at the G20 Summit of the world's largest economies. Most of the talk this week will be about the slumping global economy and whether America's recovery will be dragged down for lack of exports.
25 years ago, the people of Berlin, using sledgehammers and jackhammers, tore down the Berlin Wall. Today, Germany is celebrating with concert speeches and the release of balloons. Chancellor Angela Merkel, who grew up in East Germany, says the fall of the wall shows that the human longing for freedom cannot be suppressed forever. Meanwhile, it is Remembrance Sunday, Great Britain honoring those who fought for the country. Today's events come 100 years after the start of World War I and 70 years after D-Day. This is AP Radio News. More than 50,000 Nissan cars, trucks, and vans in a dozen states are being recalled because of faulty airbags. Violet Ekonomova has more.
The recall affects several Nissan Infiniti models from 2002 to 2006, Pathfinders from 03 and 04, and Sentras from 04 and 06. It's the latest recall for vehicles made with airbags by Takata, a Japanese supplier that's prompted 10 automakers to call back millions of cars. Takata controls about a fifth of the global airbag market and is currently the subject of a NHTSA investigation into whether it acted fast enough once the defects were found. Violet Ekonomova, New York.
In college football action, top-ranked Mississippi State had little trouble with the University of Tennessee Martin winning 45-16. Florida State beat Virginia. Number 3 Auburn stunned by Texas A&M 41-38. Number 4 Alabama needed overtime to beat 14th-ranked LSU 20-13. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
Hi, everybody. This is David and Nikki Nellis, Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
Sunday, Todd English. You know him. He's the celeb chef. He'll be in studio. And Dory Greenspan's got a new baking cookbook. She'll tell us all about it.
That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday and every Sunday at 11 right here on 1500 AM.
Did you know that birthday parties help build confidence in kids?
Yeah. Did you know that giving kids less sugar before bedtime helps them sleep better?
Oh, totally. Did you know that friendly kids have more friends?
Everybody knows that.
Hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
I didn't know that.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Danger Zone, new, tough, direct, uncompromising. Saturday morning, 7 a.m., 1500 on your AM dial. Insider information on the trouble spots of the emerging world. India, Egypt, Morocco, and their crowded regions. From retired U.S. Marine Special Forces Operator Colonel Bill Cowan and me, retired U.S. Ambassador Dick Carlson. Nothing else like it on radio or TV. Danger Zone, Saturday morning, 7 a.m. on 1500 AM.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of Opti4 Wealth Management. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Mark Cohen, who's with Opti4. We have a great lineup of guests today. Mark, will you let us know who's with us?
Sure, Pete. First, we've got Andreas Gluski, President and CEO of AES Corporation. Second is Dennis Hobb, Executive Director of the McClendon Center. Third is Amos Otis, the founder and CEO of Sobran. And we'll wind up with Phil Chaneman, the President of Tridata Corporation.
Thanks. First up is Andreas Gluski, who's the President and CEO of AES Corporation. Tell us a little bit about AES, Andreas.
Well, AES is a Fortune 200 company based in Arlington, Virginia. We provide electricity and related services. We are in 20 countries around the world. We manage about $40 billion worth of assets and have over 20,000 employees.
Well, and it's not just you provide electricity. You do it a number of different ways, apparently. How?
That's right. AES basically generates electricity by all means other than nuclear. So we have solar, we have wind, we have thermal plants that are gas, coal, and we also have hydroelectric plants. We also run distribution companies, large distribution companies. So in total, we have about 6 million clients, which is about like 50 million people that we serve around the world. And we also have about 40,000 megawatts of generation. That's about like a medium-sized country.
Right. And you're, in many ways, on the front edge of the technology of some of this. You were telling us about lithium-ion batteries and how it relates to the distribution of your business. Say a few words on that.
We are the world's leader in the use of lithium-ion batteries for grid stability. And basically, these are the batteries that you have in your computer or also run Tesla cars. And what we do is use them to stabilize the grid. And this is very important as you put more renewables on,
right?
Because they are intermittent. That means that the wind gusts and doesn't blow, or the clouds come over the solar. And this would cause fluctuations in the voltage and in the quality of electricity. Using our batteries, we can stabilize that. So that allows you to put more renewables on the grid and still keep high quality of service.
When was the company founded?
AES was founded in 1981 by two gentlemen here in D.C. It was Dennis Backey and Roger Sant. They had worked in the government, in the electricity sector, energy sector.
And when did you join the firm?
I was acquired in the year 2000. I was working for a company in Venezuela, and it was bought by AES. And I was the CFO of that company and actually had to try to raise the price at which they bought us. So I was very happy that I didn't get fired, but actually got promoted when they came in and sent to a different country.
So why do you suppose they picked you ultimately to run this company? Without being modest, why are you the ideal pick at this point in time to run this business?
Well, I think first my background, I've worked in everything from marketing to the public sector to finance. This is a company which has a lot of partnerships. It controls a lot of companies which are listed on their own. So it's a very financially driven company. So that financial background helped. I also think that, you know, we were quite successful when we were running Latin America.
And so you're from Venezuela, correct?
Yes, I was born and raised in Venezuela, but I studied here in the States. I have a doctorate from UVA.
Well, tell us a little bit about your days in Venezuela and how that's kind of shaped who you are today to run the complexity that you run.
Well, the Venezuela I grew up in was a very interesting place. I mean, Caracas at the time, probably about a fourth of the population had been actually born abroad when I grew up. So it was very international. It was a booming economy, a lot of opportunities for young people. So when I graduated from college, you know, I immediately got a very good job with Procter & Gamble, then went on with Johnson & Johnson. It was a very nice place, I think, to grow up. Unfortunately, things have gone badly there recently.
How did your parents end up in Venezuela?
Well, my father was born in Poland, and the family suffered very much in the war. But my father managed to escape from Poland after the Nazis came in. to France. He was briefly in the French army. He escaped again. He went to Britain, and there he signed up for the RAF. And he was, by the end of the war, he was a deputy wing commander of a Spitfire squadron.
What were dinner conversations like growing up?
It was very funny, yes, because my mother, my father had very different points of view, my father being more liberal, my mother being more conservative. But my mother was an educated woman, read a lot, and she was a professional, which she was a dietitian. And she had worked for about, I think, 2 years up in Mayo Clinic, up in Rochester. Couldn't stand the climate. So it was a very, as a household, there was a great variety of people coming over, variety of backgrounds and a variety of topics.
How did you come to be in the energy business at all?
It's interesting. I never started in the energy sector and probably wouldn't have thought of it. I started off, as you know, in marketing,
right,
with Procter & Gamble and Johnson & Johnson Mass Consumer Goods. I wanted to get an advanced degree. I had a scholarship from UVA. At first, I thought just to get my master's, but I went on and got my Ph.D. Then I worked in the International Monetary Fund as a desk economist. Then I went back to Venezuela, and I was the Director General of Public Finance, number two man in the Ministry of Finance, and I was running the Treasury Department and likes in my mid-30s. Then from there, I came back to the IMF. Then I went to the to a telecommunications company, which was actually owned by GTE, and was first treasurer, then CFO. I did a year as an investment banker. I didn't like that very much, very too short term. Then I got hired to the electricity sector. And what was interesting is that the CEO of that company said, look, you have the perfect background because it involves private companies, public sector, and he was right, and that was very good advice.
I mean, you were telling us that it's a very complex business. It's not just delivering energy. It's also forming relationships with countries themselves. Say a little bit about that.
Yes, well, AES, we were in 20 countries. And actually, we were in 30 before I started as CEO. I got us out of 10. But this means that because of the size of the projects you deal a lot with public policy. So you're dealing a lot with ministers and even presidents of countries. So that when you're in this business, yeah, you are highly regulated and you're highly important to the economy. So you must take these considerations. So my background from the public sector helps me put myself in other people's shoes.
Who would you say your biggest role model or mentor was growing up, other than your mom and dad?
That's interesting. I was much sort of a bookworm in a sense. So probably almost like historical figures.
That's where most of mine came from. As I learned it by reading. Yeah. How about that?
So you mentioned a minute ago that you weren't happy with being an investment banker because it was too short term, and I'm thinking most people want quick profits, not waiting a long time. So tell us more about this.
Well, when you're an investment banker, long term is 6 months. It's the deal. You live and die for the deal. What I like about the jobs that I've enjoyed most is that you have a longer term perspective. So we have perspectives of 5-6 years down the road. So I really like seeing projects develop, come to fruition. I like seeing mentoring people. I really like seeing teams work. But it's very gratifying to see at the end of the day that you've done something. You can go out there and see the wind farm and see the turbines moving. And so that's part of some of the most enjoyable parts of my job.
Is part of your job advocating new methods of generating electricity?
Yes, it is. Interesting that you say that. I recently was in the Philippines and had the opportunity to talk to the president of the Philippines, Ninoy Aquino, and these batteries work extremely well in islands, and he wants to do more renewables. So we had a very interesting conversation how we could make the Philippines, for example, outside the U.S., the world leader in using lithium-ion batteries for grid stability.
Where do you see the company in 5 years?
Well, AES has about, again, $40 billion of assets under management, and we're really using partnerships to be able to grow quicker. So I could see the company, again, having this unique relationship to the countries where it operates, and not just foreign investor, but have local partners as well, and being considerably larger and really playing a role in integrating new technologies with traditional means of electricity. So I think we're on our way to being a quite unique company with a unique culture.
How about your biggest challenge as the CEO?
Well, since I've been CEO, really, we've had a lot of things go right. We've had the worst drought in 100 years along the Eastern Pacific Rim. And this has affected us particularly in Latin America. And this is really something off the charts. So really, our biggest challenge has been hitting our numbers despite, you know, for example, not having as much water as we need in our hydro plants.
And how do you deal with something like that?
Well, you know, there's nothing you can really do about the weather.
Yeah,
so you
no
have
kidding.
To make it up other places. And going down the road, what we have to do is make the make sure we have enough thermal and other, you know, wind, other resources available so that if there ever is that 1-in-100-year drought, we're less exposed.
Right. What's the most difficult thing you've ever accomplished, Andres?
Difficult thing. Well, I think that when you have to make a company more efficient, is always very difficult. Laying off people is very tough. So, you know, I have had, unfortunately, in my life, I'd say maybe 2 or 3 times when I've had to do this. So that's always very tough.
Yeah, I can imagine. What's the website address?
AES.com.
AES.com? Thank you. We've been speaking with Andres Gluski, the president and CEO of AES Corporation. I'd like to thank Mark Cohen with Opti4 for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Cassie Self, Marketing Manager, Buchanan & Edwards. Cassie, what is Buchanan & Edwards?
We are an IT consulting firm, and we are committed to bringing innovation and efficiency to our federal clients.
And what's your role in the company?
My role in the company is leading both the internal and external marketing and communications initiatives, and really connecting our employees with our executives and our management team, but then also, you know, relaying our messages to our customers.
And what do you like most about your job?
The people.
What is it about the people that makes them special?
Everybody at the company has, you know, a certain level of excitement, and you know, you really see their passion for helping our clients.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think your clients appreciate about the company?
I think that our clients, first, you know, they appreciate our quality. All of our employees are really committed to helping our clients improve their business functions, and you know, bringing that level of quality.
Mm-hmm. And what do you enjoy most about your work?
I would say the people, again, you know, the people that I interact with every day, and the team that I work with, and being able to share our message and our, you know, our solution with our clients.
That's great. Who do you think is the perfect kind of client for Buchanan Edwards?
An organization that an organization that has a lot of processes set in place that could be improved with technology, improved, you know, by bringing efficiency and, you know, automating a lot of stuff.
That's great. What's the website for the company?
www.buchanan-edwards.com.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Cassie Self, Marketing Manager at Buchanan & Edwards. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
And your name is?
Tony Altamari.
And Tony, what organization are you with?
With or Without Philly Cheesesteaks.
And what makes With or Without Philly Cheesesteaks special?
We're the only born and raised authentic Philly cheesesteak concept in the world.
Hmm. And you're based here in Philadelphia?
Absolutely.
And you're beginning some sort of a national expansion program?
We are rolling out our franchise model.
Mm-hmm.
We are having an expo on February 6th.
Mm-hmm.
In Fort Washington.
And the franchise models to help folks in other parts of the country get into the business, because you've got a special format that's worked, and you're going to show them how to do it too?
We have a proven business model for Philadelphia cheesesteaks, and we are going to organically grow from Philadelphia out. And it's to educate people about the Philly cheesesteak and With or Without.
So the benefit to the franchisee is you've got an established model that's proven, so they can learn the systems and procedures that they can follow in order to be successful as well. Is that correct?
That's correct. We give them a business model for them to use and to grow their business and help them become successful.
And you've built successful businesses previously, so they can get a clear sense that you can do this and that they can follow your lead because you've had previous success.
Absolutely, yes.
I understand. What's the website address for this With or Without Philly cheesesteaks?
It's witorwithout.com. Obviously no H's. That's witorwithout.com.
.com. Excellent. We've been speaking to Tony Altomare, founder of Wit or Without Philly Cheesesteaks. Here on Executive Leaders Radio, this has been your Business Spotlight.
Back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of Opti4 Wealth Management. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Mark Cohen, with Opti4. For this segment, we have Dennis Hobb, who's the executive director of a company called the McClendon Center. What is the McClendon Center, Dennis?
The McClendon Center is an outpatient mental health clinic. We serve people with serious mental illnesses in the District of Columbia.
How long has the organization been around?
We were formed in 1980. We were created by a church as a ministry of the church. But back in 2003, we separated and became our own 501c3 organization.
And in terms of size, how would you characterize yourself?
In the district, we're kind of considered a smaller program. Some agencies serve thousands of people, but we serve around 800 people a year, and I think we do it really well because of our size.
And we were talking in the green room about some of the misconceptions about the mentally challenged. What, clear up one for us.
Well, the biggest one, and I know we talked about this before, was that people with mental illnesses are violent. Studies have shown that only about half of, in the population, about half the population is violent. I'm not saying exactly the way I wanted to. If you look at the general population, the rate of violence among the mentally ill is 50% of what it is in the general population.
So they're less violent than the regular population.
About half. But if they commit a crime that's violent, the mental illness is always tied to that.
Yeah, yeah. How long have you been the executive director?
4.5 years.
And is this the first time running the show for you?
Yes and no. When I was in the Midwest, I ran divisions of larger agencies. Uh-huh. So it's almost the same, but not quite the same.
Why did you want the job?
I didn't want the job. I never wanted to be in charge of anything like this. But I believe in what the agency does. And so when my boss retired in 4 years ago was, I knew that I wanted to do this because I wanted the agency to continue, and I thought I could offer something to it.
So you've been at the helm here for 4.5 years running it. And when you look back on it, why are you the ideal pick to run this business?
I think for a couple of reasons. One is I have really good organizational and leadership skills, and we've been able to continue doing the good work we've done. But also, we were in a pretty serious financial situation 4.5 years ago, and we've come out of that with pretty well. So I think that some of the plans we put in place, I was the right person to probably do that and oversee it.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up?
I grew up on a farm in Missouri. I'm in my late 50s, but I'm probably one of the few people in this room or in this building that grew up without running water or telephones. We got those when I was 8. We got running water when I was 10.
But you had electricity.
We did have electricity because I watched a lot of TV when I was a kid. That was my connection to the outside world.
But you grew up on a farm.
Yeah, it was about 180 acres, and we did everything.
What was the crop?
We did corn, soybeans, and did a lot of hay.
Yeah. Did you work on the farm?
Oh, yeah.
What in what capacity?
I drove the tractor a lot. I got a lot of sunburns.
How young were you when you were working the farm?
Oh, gosh. My brother and I were helping my dad out when we were 8 or 9.
Yeah. What do you remember most about that experience?
I remember how hard it was, and just the fact that you would start early and end late and would pray for rainy days so you'd have a day off.
What was your father like?
My dad was an interesting guy. He was a lot older than my mother, but he's also really playful. So one of the things I remember about him was all of us kids chasing him up a tree one day. So he climbed this tree. But this guy, he worked so hard all the time, as did my mom. I mean, they were just such hard workers.
Life as a farmer is pretty tough, I'm guessing.
It's pretty hard.
So you apparently didn't want to be a farmer.
It was not what I wanted to do. I guess when I was a kid living in the middle of nowhere, I always knew I was a city boy. So when I could, I moved to town.
You said that there was a point in time when it became clear to you that there's a segment of the population that has no voice, and you wanted to do something about that.
Yeah, I think the biggest experience for me was when my oldest niece was born. She was born with cerebral palsy, and living in a part of the country where there aren't many services, my sister had to just do major advocacy to get what she needed, and it kind of brought forth that whole notion of working for the underdog.
Yeah, and so you went to college, right?
Yes.
What'd you major in?
Psychology.
And then after that, what happened?
After that, I went right on to graduate school. I got a degree in counseling and guidance. So I was trained as actually a guidance counselor, but didn't want to do that. So started working in social service work.
And then what prepared you to lead? You characterize yourself as a good leader. How do you know?
I think two things. One is seeing it done badly, and now you don't want to do it like that. But also, I received a lot of training in one of my first jobs in situational leadership, which looks at people on the scales of willingness and ability. And so for me, if someone isn't able, you teach them. And if someone isn't willing, you try to persuade them. If in the end you can't do either one of those things, then perhaps it's not the right fit for a job for someone.
Right. What's it like to no longer touch the very work that got you here? Now you're directing people who do it.
Well, actually, because our agency is small, I still get to do some of that. I think the joy for me is seeing that the processes we put in place work for everybody. So even though I'm not directly touching them, what I've helped to do touches people in a really systemic and broad way.
Where would you like the organization to be 5 years from now?
I would love to have us be a little bit more financially stable. In social service work, that's not always possible. I'd like to see that our workforce is a little more stable, because a lot of our jobs, our entry-level jobs, they turn over a lot. So I'd love to be able to see a little bit more longevity in those positions.
Can you think of one of your clients that you've worked with that sort of stands out, that has a really interesting story?
Oh, I can think of lots of them, but I think of one in particular. Several years ago, we had a young man who was referred to us who was addicted to painkillers, and he had been in a number of different treatment centers, so he came to our therapeutic day program. He was homeless, and he was spending a lot of times in emergency rooms just because that was how he could be warm for the evening. So eventually, he was able to get clean and to stay clean, and actually was able to get a job as a manager in a large box store here in Virginia. And then he got married, and we never heard from him again, which is exactly how it ought to be, that we work ourselves out of a job, and people go on to live their lives.
So this must be tremendously satisfying for you.
It is. I mean, frustrating in some ways, because you see that mental illness is always going to be here. Yeah. But when you get these success stories and you see people's lives begin to change, then it's very satisfying.
On the toughest day, when nothing's going right, what makes it worth it for you?
As I said earlier, I think it's my cynical but sunny disposition, where I actually know that things are going to work out okay. I had a boss who once said, things are always going to be okay no matter how dark they look. And even though he and I probably had some differences, I've always remembered that, and it stuck with me.
Do you have corporate partners that help you out financially, or do you all funded by the government?
We are 98% funded by the government. So our role in the next few years is to create some corporate partners and more giving.
So why don't you take this as an opportunity to tell corporate and industry why they should be helping out?
Well, you should help out because you have mentally ill people all around you, and probably in your family. And if you don't, you may. So investing in a company like ours, who actually does good work and humane work, is something you should be paying for.
Do people that go through your program become good employees?
Sometimes. There are those who will never become good employees, but we help them to not become nuisances in the community either, and to live more productive lives.
What's your proudest moment up till now, Dennis?
That's a good question. I think probably it just happened recently. We had an open house last week for one of our locations. It was recently remodeled. And just knowing the staff who'd come back to see that, and the colleagues I work with who were saying such good things about our agency,
great.
It made me very proud.
What's the website address?
www.mclendoncenter.org.
Thank you. We're going to speak with Dennis Hubb, who's the executive director of the McClendon Center. I'd like to thank Mark Cohen for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. Welcome, Jody. Jody, what is Acumetrics?
Acumetrics is a firm that works with CEOs that are interested in growing their revenues and bottom lines in a scalable, sustainable way.
And what's your role within the company?
I'm the founder and president.
And what is it about the job that you bring that's so unique to you, that special gift, as we say?
That special gift? I enjoy working with the CEOs to have them achieve goals that they thought were impossible.
And what is it about the organization that makes it so special?
We work, our clients say that it's the three P's: our people, our platform, and our processes. Our people are highly qualified and they're fun to work with. Mm-hmm. Our processes are enabling of reliable and timely financial information, and our platform is scalable.
And who is, or what is, perhaps, the perfect client for you?
Businesses of any size that want reliable, timely financial information.
Mm-hmm. And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I enjoy working with the clients and making a difference. We like to help the CEOs understand their financial information so they can make different choices tomorrow to impact future results of the business.
That's great. What's the website for the company?
www.acumetricsllc.com.
Thank you, Jody.
Thanks, Les.
We've been speaking with Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. This is Les Smollett, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
This is Colin Callahan, and this is your Business Spotlight.
Hi, my name is Ed Tolchin.
And what company do you work with?
I work with Offutt Kerman, and we're a law firm located pretty much up and down the East Coast.
Uh-huh. And what's special about Offutt Kerman?
Well, Offutt Kerman is really a great place if you are a mid-market type firm that needs hands-on legal services that can get you what you want at a price that you can afford.
Why do you enjoy your work?
I enjoy my work because I find it intellectually challenging. I get calls from very interesting people, very interesting clients all the time with problems that really need some thinking, and I like thinking and strategizing.
Uh-huh. What's most fun about that?
It's always new, always different, and it's unique. Uh-huh. A lot of lawyers can look up the law and tell you, well, the statute says X, Y, and Z. Well, what we do here is we look up the law, we tell you the statute does, says X, Y, and Z, and here's how you deal with that statute. Here's what you do in order to comply with that statute in a way that gets you what you need.
Sounds perfect. What is your perfect customer base? Who are you looking for?
Perfect customer is a customer in the in a mid-market type business, a lot of technology companies. Mm-hmm. We try to represent people who are entrepreneurs, who have great ideas because, as I said, they give us the most interesting problems to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like anybody who's looking for some strategy help is, we combined with legal is the right. Well, great. And what's the special sauce that's a little different than your competition?
You know what? I think what makes Offutt Kerman unique and different is that we provide Wall Street competence with Main Street accessibility.
And what's your website?
www.offuttkerman.com. That's OFFITKURMAN.
Great. This is Colin Callahan, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of Opt4 Wealth Management. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Mark Cohen. And for this segment, we have a young man by the name of Amos Leon Otis, who's the founder and CEO of a company called SoBrand. Tell us a little bit about SoBrand, Amos.
SoBrand started in 1986, and we are a government contracting company. Basically, about 80% of our business is government contracting. Other is commercial. We're divided into three divisions, engineering and logistics, bioscience, and security services.
So the company was started in 1986. I'll bet you have a long history of Harvard Graduate School business preparation. Is that how you got here?
Negative.
No? How'd you get here?
I spent 21 years in the Air Force, and during that time I had an opportunity to work in industry as a junior executive and then to get an MBA and migrate into various acquisition and finance positions, which put me in a position to understand corporate America and business.
So prior to 1986, you spent 21 years in the Air Force.
That is correct.
Why did you want to be in the Air Force?
It was a dream of mine as a young man. I grew up around an Air Force base, and I met some of the officers. And
where
I
was this?
This was in Montgomery, Alabama.
Uh-huh.
And I knew at that time that's all I wanted to be.
And you knew at that time?
Yes.
What was it that was so intriguing and attractive to you?
Well, the individuals I met were well-spoken, well-behaved. They carried themselves well. And they had an education, and they also had opportunities to be in areas of society that I could not and my family could not participate in. And I knew that would be an avenue to get into areas that I couldn't go any other way.
You were telling us in the green room you would sit up on the roof of the house and watch down onto the base and watch things go on?
Yes, I would daydream, just sit there and look.
How old were you when you were doing that?
Oh, I had to be around 12.
Uh-huh.
And
You had it early. You were going to do this.
Yes, that was it for me.
So tell us about your years in the Air Force. How did it shape you as a man? How did it shape you as a leader of a business? How were you impacted by this experience?
Well, the military gave me an opportunity to, again, be in areas that I would not have gotten into given the normal progression of my contemporaries. And I started out in flight school and then into the Titan missile arena, where I was a combat crew commander, which gave me an opportunity to go to training with industry, where I learned and about the operations of corporate America, which transitioned into being a part of it through being a Air Force plant representative as a quality control officer.
So you got a lot of good technical training and skills and knowledge.
Management training also, right. In that period.
But you tell us that you were really formed, your basic character as a man, by your grandfather.
Yes, my grandfather basically raised me. My mother and father divorced when I was 6, and my grandfather took up the position.
Tell us a little bit about your grandfather.
He was a very proud man, he was uneducated, but he spoke very well, he carried himself well, and he taught me the rules of existence and how important education was.
Right. So you grew up in the Deep South, and you're an African American. Tell us a little bit about what that was like.
Well, you knew the rules, and it was rough. If you stepped outside the lines, you were summarily punished in one way.
So that kind of experience could break some people's spirit. It didn't break yours. Why?
Because the community and my family were very close-knit. They knew the rules. They taught you how to work within them, and that what education and discipline would get you out of that situation, and they insisted on you doing that.
Mm-hmm. So the years in the Air Force really shaped. When did you realize... At what point in the military did you realize I'm going to start a business?
I didn't really. I knew that I had a very good broad education as to what the basics and the principles of business were. And I didn't get an opportunity to exercise that until I was retired from the military and decided to go into it on my own after I had no other choice.
So what surprised you the most about you're not in the military anymore, now you're running a company? What was that like?
Learning that everybody doesn't have the same discipline that you have as a military person.
You also tell us about having fought really hard for some business and losing.
Yes.
What was that experience like?
That was devastating because I knew that I couldn't lose because I had run that program. Everybody who were the evaluators knew me. They knew that I knew everything, and I worked with them.
So, but you weren't broken by that either. You took that loss. You told us you went down to the basement, and you created a sign that sticks over your desk today. What is that sign?
And that sign says, you only fail when you fail to try again. And that's been my motto. And I've had plenty of failures, but I go right back in, and I run up against them until I succeed.
So you've been at it since 1986. That's quite a long time. What does it take to succeed in business?
Discipline. It's probably the most important factor I can that I could advise anyone to have. You must be disciplined, and you have to learn the principles of business, but you have to be disciplined to execute them.
So would you characterize yourself as a good leader? Without being modest.
Yes, I think I'm a good leader.
Okay, what's a good leader? How do you define it?
A person who can define the goals and show that there are paths to it, and you have to be a part of leading and exercising the principles to get there.
So you're joined by your daughter today. I'd like to welcome Soma to the interview.
Thank you.
So what do you think of this guy sitting next to you?
Well, I think he's a wonderful person, a wonderful man, and I'm very proud of him and everything that he's accomplished. He leads through example. He leads through his actions, and everything that he says he is, he does. And it shows in his business, and it shows in his staff who respect him and will do anything to make Sobran a great company.
So, Soma, I'm curious, because we talked in the green room about a time when your dad had failed in landing a contract that he should have gotten, and it was a pretty serious failure, and things were going to change. And he describes that he brought the family together and talked about how things were going to change. Maybe you're going to have to quit college. Mm-hmm. What were you thinking at the time?
I was unsure of what was going to happen. You know, I was scared. But being the man that he is, he said, no, you know what, we're going to get through this. I'm going to make this work. I know what I have to do. And he asked the family to help get us over the hump. I had to take out a loan, pay my own student loans, which I am now grateful for, because it taught me that whatever you want, you've got to work for it.
Do you have a role in the business today?
Yes, so I do.
What do you do for the company?
I'm director of executive services. I head the marketing group, and I make sure that the company as a whole runs smoothly.
Why did you want to be a part of your father's company?
Because it is his legacy, and it will be my legacy. And mm-hmm. I love what he's doing, and I love where the company's going, and I'm grateful to be a part of it.
Amos, what's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
The toughest thing that I've ever accomplished, convincing myself that this is going to work.
The business?
Yes.
At what point did you realize it was going to?
That it was going to work?
Yeah.
There were quite a few iterations, and I kept pushing, and finally I got a call from the Small Business Administration that says, come over to the base, we've got a contract for you perhaps. And I said, okay. I went over, I got the proposal, the request for a proposal. I went back and drew it up, and it was horrible. And I turned it in, they rejected it. But there was a friend of mine who worked there, and they found out that it had gone down the tubes, and they said, listen, I'll help you with this. And we sat together and worked it over and turned it back in, and it was accepted. I'll always be grateful to that person.
Great.
So, Amos, if you were to talk to a young man or young woman in the Deep South right now, what would you tell them?
I would tell them that education, their education is paramount, that without it, they don't stand a chance. But if they do, they can succeed in any area they want to endeavor.
So you're very active in giving back at the moment. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing in that regard.
Well, I support and set an endowment up at the Catholic school that my sister and I attended. And well, she passed, and I set it up in her name. I have an endowment at the university that my sister and I attended, and that's going quite well. I support a abused woman's home in Dayton, Ohio, with funds and a vehicle to take the kids around.
That's wonderful. If I was interviewing your grandfather, what would he say about you?
Oh,
it's okay. What would his grandfather say about him?
His grandfather would be so proud of him. Daddy Leon is what he was named in the family. And he was an amazing man, like he said. He didn't have any education, but he made sure that his family knew that they were special and that they could accomplish anything they put his mind to. And all the things that Daddy Leon had to endure, he did it with a smile on his face because he wanted his children to have a better life.
Yeah, thank you for that. So what's the website address, Amos?
That's SoBrand-Inc.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Amos Leon Otis, who's the founder and CEO of SoBrand, joined by his daughter, Soma Otis Martin. I'd like to thank Mark Cohen for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, Executive Leaders Radio, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment after the Business Spotlight.
Here for today's Business Spotlight is Chris Vannetti, Vice President of Contract and Project Staffing Services at Hire Strategy. Chris, what is Hire Strategy?
Hire Strategy is a D.C. Metro-based professional services and staffing firm specializing in information technology placements as well as HR and administrative, sales and marketing, and accounting and finance.
And what do clients love about working with Hire Strategy?
We take an old school approach to staffing. And what I mean by that is, you know, back in the day before social media and email, it was all about people. And we're one of the few and last firms in this marketplace, probably nationwide, that really interviews in person, takes the time to know their candidates, and 100% takes the time to know their clients, their pushes and pulls, the positives and negatives, to make the right match. So it's truly a consultative approach.
Mm-hmm. What do employees love about working for Hire Strategy?
It's definitely our culture. And the employees that work for us, I think they would all to a person say, we believe in leadership, not management. And that's one of our key mottos. And leading people is a definite thing that we like to do, and we like to do it often.
So what does that mean for a new employee? They get to be a leader?
They can get to be a leader, but they're leader of their own practice, of their own business. We allow them to be entrepreneurial. We allow them to make their own decisions, and we're there to help them along the way, correct them if need be. But motivation and leadership is the one way that we think that people are going to excel with us.
What do you love most about your job?
I love that I get the opportunity to be a leader and to be entrepreneurial and work with a great bunch of people and a great group of executives along with myself. So it's a great place to be.
What's the website?
The website is www.hirestrategy.com.
Thank you for listening to this Business Spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett, a law firm. Mark, welcome. What is Cohn & Burnett?
We are a law firm that focuses on trusts and estates. So we do wills, trusts, powers of attorney, estate planning, and estate administration.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the founder and the senior partner.
So what does that mean to be a senior partner?
Well, it means that in our case, I'm the thought leader, the visionary, the one who tries to figure out where we're headed. I'm not the managing partner who runs the day-to-day operations.
Okay, and what makes Cohn & Burnett so special?
We are, first of all, focused on taking care of our clients and just on their estate planning and administration. And I think we're one of the first firms in the area to introduce a fixed fee for doing estate planning.
Interesting. And what do they really appreciate about you and the company, your clients, that is?
You know, the clients tell me that they just love the experience. They are very comfortable and confident that their needs are being met here, and they enjoy working with us.
Hmm. And who or what is your perfect client, if you will?
Our perfect client is anybody who cares about what's going to happen to them when they can no longer take care of themselves or their family.
Mm-hmm. And what is it you actually enjoy most about the work?
You know, talking to the clients, that's the part. I could turn over all of the work to other attorneys here, but I hold on to the first part, which is meeting the clients, talking to them, getting to know them, getting to understand what they need and what they're looking for.
That's great. What's the website for Cohn & Burnett?
CohnAndBurnett.com, all spelled out, the A and D in between there.
Thank you, Mark. We've been speaking with Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
And your name is?
Dana Theus.
And the name of the organization?
EmpowerCoaching.com.
And what does Empower Coaching do?
Well, we support mid-level to senior managers mm-hmm. and leaders mm-hmm. Achieve professional success by developing themselves personally.
Why does this turn you on so much?
Well, I have found in my own experience and my own leadership journey mm-hmm. that the better I was at being a good human being, the better mm-hmm. leader and the better business I ran and mm-hmm. the more successful I was. And I want to help other people do that.
So you're able to help the folks in an organization throughout the organization achieve what they're looking for, as well as help the organization move forward.
Well, to move an organization forward, mm-hmm. you've got to master the soft skills of mm-hmm. dealing with people effectively.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to learn to negotiate every relationship successfully mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. both parties. Mm-hmm. You have to communicate confidently.
Mm-hmm.
I support people and help them learn to develop those skills themselves to be strong mm-hmm. leaders.
And you have a specialty working with women?
I do work a lot with women. Mm-hmm. They're drawn to this work, but not mm-hmm. exclusively.
Mm-hmm. And to learn more about what you're up to, is there a website address?
InPowerCoaching.com. That's InPowerCoaching.com.
Excellent. This has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of Opti4 Wealth Management. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and I'm joined by my co-host, Mark Cohn, with Opti4. For this segment, we have Phil Shainman, who's the president of a company called Tri-Data Corp. What is Tri-Data Corp, Phil?
Tri-Data is a public safety consulting and research firm.
What does that mean to the layman?
We do three things. We do consulting for police and fire departments across the nation on management and organization, trying to improve their efficiency and effectiveness. We do after-action reports on major disasters, major shootings like the Aurora Theater shooting. And we do a great deal of research on how to prevent disasters, how to prevent fires and injuries.
And the business has been around for 33 years, and you're the founder, is that correct?
I'm the founder as a part of a subsidiary of System Planning Corporation, which is our parent company.
Yeah, so this is pretty complex stuff. How'd you get the idea?
Well, I had been in the federal government immediately before as Associate Administrator of U.S. Fire Administration. And after about 5 years in the federal government, I had all the fun I could take and then left to start Tri-Data, and that was 33 years ago. But before that, I had been at the Urban Institute doing research on how do you measure effectiveness and productivity of local government services. And not knowing any better, I tried to tackle police and fire, which they gave me as a challenge to do. And that led to a whole change of career.
So give us an example, and don't be modest, how your work has impacted the state and local governments. Give us a success story kind of thing.
We have done a lot of research around the world on what works best in fire prevention. And one of the best ideas was home visits. And we found that if you can get firefighters into homes to actually check smoke alarms and install ones that are needed, you can have some very dramatic reductions in fire deaths. So what's very thrilling to me is when I was in Britain and people knew some of the research I had done, and a British fire chief told my wife, who was with me, your husband saved 450 deaths in our city
now
over the last 5 years.
That's quite a legacy.
And
what's it feel like to hear that?
And it's very thrilling. And one of my goals early in life was to try to do something internationally important. For some reason, I had this thing. I wanted to do research that was internationally important.
How young were you when you got that bubble?
And I guess I was in my 20s, just starting out as an engineer working on the manned space program. And the career has moved over a trajectory that nobody could have predicted.
You characterize yourself as a bridge that connects really two ideas or two populations. Say a little bit more about that.
I think it's very important to bridge the gap between technology and human beings and human services. And I've always been interested both in technology and the human side of things, and see myself as a bridge between the two, in being able to translate and communicate ideas from one to the other.
So give us an example of where you see the need to bridge the two.
Well, there's all kinds of technologies out there now, for example, in robotics that the military uses, and I see many applications for them for the fire service, and I've been trying to get the fire service to use some of these new technologies. There's also bridging in doing things like survey work and trying to understand attitudes of police and fire toward prevention. They really like the action side of the job rather than the prevention side.
Right.
And so it's trying to understand what makes them tick.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the Bronx.
What was life growing up in the Bronx like?
It was a lot of fun playing stickball and punch ball in the streets. We didn't have organized sports.
I played sports, stickball, by the way.
We had sports every day.
Yeah.
And it was very exciting. And it's hard to imagine today that within walking distance, I had about 2 million people.
Wow.
And all kinds of stores. And now I have to get in a car for everything.
What were you like as a kid?
I was fairly serious and studious. And my mother was holding me to excellence academically. And
give us the specifics.
Well, the classic anecdote was coming home with 94 on a test, and my mother said, "What happened to the other 6 points?" And that somehow or other scarred me.
Well, either that or kind of it stuck, and you're always looking for the other 6 points. Is that a fair question?
Yes. So
excellence is really important to you.
Yes, and if we lose a proposal now, we always want to know, how did we lose the points? Why didn't we win that job?
Right. What's it like to lead this company? I mean, what's it take to be a leader in today's business environment?
Well, I live a very unusual company. It's a maverick of its sort. And we have to both be technically competent and also able to adapt to a very wide variety of public safety clients very quickly. So it's been very exciting. Very demanding, We're continually running across the ice floes.
So you were trained as an engineer, but now you're in a very important leadership position. Where did you learn your leadership skills?
I had good communication skills, despite just stuttering for a moment right now. I had good communication skills early on. And when I was in college, I took sciences and liberal arts. And that turned out to be a key for getting promoted very early in my first company when I was working on the manned space program. I was younger supervisor, and mainly because I was able to define new work and explain what we were doing. And so they dared have me, when I was 26, speak to the board of directors of AT&T, which was a big deal at the time, on strategies for saving them money. And I got hooked on management science and said, why can't we be applying some of these good ideas the Bell System was using to our cities? And wound up working at the Urban Institute doing some pioneering research in how do you measure effectiveness and productivity of local government services.
So you have an interesting hobby you shared with us. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, when my company moved to a new location in Arlington, I wandered around the neighborhood and stumbled into a dance studio, which is now DK Ballroom, and took a lesson and wound up getting hooked. And after 5 years, I'm now a competitive ballroom dancer nationally.
That's unbelievable. And you credit that for your longevity in business. Is that true?
Yes. I would have been close to retiring, but this sort of rejuvenated me, both physically
and
mentally.
How does that happen? I mean, tell us about that, the relationship between that and staying fresh.
Well, it turns out, I mean, research has shown that dancing is very good for you mentally as well as physically. In fact, it's considered the best exercise to ward off Alzheimer's. And it keeps you young. And so people don't realize how old I am when I go out and compete. And it's just been an absolutely terrific activity. I've always liked ballroom dancing, but never had much opportunity to do it, let alone think about competing in it.
So, I mean, for some reason, it was such a surprise to hear, because I see it as such a kind of a structured set of steps, and it's not very spontaneous at all, and you seem to be an out-of-the-box kind of thinker. I'm wondering how you do both.
Well, the exciting thing in the competitive ballroom is continually refining your routines. And most of the imagination comes from my instructor, Daria Zotova, who invents the new routines and then tries to keep bringing me up the level of how to do them. But it's the excelling and continually seeing ways to use your body to do things better that just strikes me as remarkable. And it's a great contrast to what I have to do every day.
Yeah. What's the website address, Phil?
It's tridatacorp.com.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Phil Shenman, who's the president of Tridata Corp. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today. Mark, will you take us through that?
Sure. We started off with Andres Gluski, the president and CEO of AES Corporation. Then we talked to Dennis Hobb, the executive director of the McClendon Center. Third was Amos Leon Otis, together with his daughter Soma Otis Martin. Amos is the founder and CEO of Sobran. And we were just talking to Phil Shenman, president of Tridata Corp.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Mark Cohen, my co-host, for helping me with the interview today. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to hear more about our executive leaders. And to hear this show again, please tune in to businesstalkradio.net. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government.
Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
This paid commercial may not